Technorama episode 648, computers, they bite. Welcome to Technorama. This is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time joining us, thank you very much. It is going to be a lot of fun, I assure you. There's going to be nerddom and geekery and tomfoolery and maybe Jerry foolery. And well, I'm Chuck Tomasi, and we're off to a good start. And with me, as always, is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I'm Craig Foolery. And this Chuck Tomasser Furley.
We should have just called this the Foolery Podcast. Why didn't we think of that? It would have been so much more obvious when people are thumbing through podcasts. I want that one. Foolery.
That's right. Technofoolery. Cool. I'll take it. No, I'm doing good.
We're a little late for a rebranding at this point.
Yeah, you know, we're 16 years in, so.
We can always stop this one and start another one that sounds just like it.
Yeah. Right.
Then you have to go find new music, new
it's
album.
Like we're in the
art.
Witness protection program, but we can't help but podcast.
We do have a webinar together that we do once a month. It's a little more straight laced than this business type stuff. More, you know,
yeah. And there was the name is similar.
Yes.
So there's once or twice I'm ready for you to say the wrong name on the podcast.
Yeah. I say, welcome to Tech Now.
That's right. Spit it out.
Like that video where they were trying to draw, you know, seven lines all perpendicular to each other.
Oh.
And he says, now can you make one in the shape of a kitten? No, you can't make one in the shape of a kitten.
Can you use the green marker and make it blue?
And three of the lines need to be in invisible ink. Like, right. What does that even mean? If you don't know what we're talking about, go search for it on YouTube. It's very funny. Anyone who does requirements for software, for architecture, for anything will laugh.
Actually,
at
you know what? Go look at our. I'll put it in the show notes, but I'll put a link to that on our Facebook page.
Should we get on with the feedback because we sent out our question of the week?
Yeah,
let's take a look. You take the Technorama page. Letters. I'll take the Chuck page.
Every day.
Yeah, boost that up a little bit.
Mailman, mailman, mail today. Reach right in and pull one out.
I got no responses.
I love those letters. Let's find out what you got to say.
I know where this is going.
Mailman, mail today.
Must be a mail carrier strike. You didn't get your messages.
I'm going to the Technorama page also. Hopefully we got more than one so we can share.
We did. We got two.
One for each of us. Mm-hmm. All right. First one is from John Miller Jr. Why don't you go ahead and start that out?
Okay. John Miller Jr. says, what's the question of the week? The question of the week is, what fictional company would you like to work for?
Okay.
And John Miller Jr. said, the Daily Planet. I get to follow Clark Kent around and constantly tell him that he looks like Superman.
Anybody ever tell you?
No, don't get away from me, kid.
Did anybody ever tell you?
Yeah. Do you know who you look like? Kevin Costner.
Steve London says Blue Sun from Firefly or Terrell Corporation from Blade Runner, depending on the salary. Who pays
right.
more?
Yeah. You got to play your cards right there, Steve.
All right. We will be getting more answers in on that during the week. We always do and appreciate it greatly as you respond to that. It's funny because I've gotten answers to things we wrote two or three weeks ago. What order is Facebook putting this person's feed in if they're seeing this now?
Yeah.
But thank you very much. We're going to have that. That's a short one. We'll have another question for you at the end of the show. This is not the end of the show. Don't leave.
Yeah. Stay here. Thank you and good night.
Just following the feedback is the history. On this day in history for August 18, 2021, this is the 230th day of the year in the Gregorian calendar, and there are only 135 days now remaining in 2021. It was on this date in 1783 that a huge fireball meteor was seen across Great Britain as it passed over the East Coast.
It only happened the one time ever. And that same date in 1868, French astronomer Pierre Janssen discovered helium.
And birthday parties were never the same.
Neither were people changing their voices.
Right. Hey, Craig, Mr. Apocalypse.
That's right.
Okay, 118 years ago today, German engineer Karl Jatto, yes, we'll go with that, allegedly flew his self-made motored gliding airplane 4 months before the first flight of the Wright brothers. But since nobody was there to take a picture or write it down.
Yeah. Sorry.
No picture. Didn't happen. On August 18th, 2020, the new Microsoft Flight Simulator was launched in much fanfare because I've heard all good things about it.
That is a stark gap in events from 118 years ago to 1 year ago today.
Hey, look, so you went from somebody allegedly flying to somebody being able to fly in their house.
To virtually flying.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
That's right.
Oh, Karl Jatto, you should have just waited for Flight Simulator to come out.
Been a little safer.
Oh, this is much better. Okay, happy birthday goes out of this date to Italian composer and conductor Antonio Salieri. Remember Amadeus movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, with F. Murray Abrahams. Yeah. What can one hear when they hear this music except Salieri? He was born today in 1750.
And Meriwether Lewis, American soldier, explorer, and politician, was born on the same date in 1774.
He was one half of that famous explorer group, Lewis and Frankfurt. Lewis and Clark.
That's it. Oh, yeah.
American businessman, the man who founded Marshall Fields. Guess what his name was?
Herbert.
No, his name was Marshall Field. That'd be like making a store chain called Craig Steps.
Yeah.
Nothing magnanimous about that. He was born 187 years ago today.
An American businessman, Max Factor Jr., born on this date in 1904.
Ah, Max Factor, the makeup guy. I remember seeing his name all the time at the end of I Love Lucy. Born August 18th, 1911, Hungarian computer scientist and programmer Clara Don von Neumann. Yes.
Neumann.
The man who made the von Neumann machines, or at least came up with the idea of them.
Yeah. An American actress, Shelley Winters, was born on this date in 1920.
Also born that same date in 1933, French-Polish director, producer, screenwriter, and actor Roman Polanski. I always thought he was either born in Rome or Poland.
I think I knew it was Poland. And Vincent Bugliosi, the American lawyer and author, was born 87 years ago today.
Yeah, you want to read some interesting stuff about him or by him. It's all about the Manson murders and the trials
right.
And what. That's where you know his name from. Also right. Turning 78 years old today is American actor and comedian Martin Mull. I don't know if he's still alive because of the word of the phrasing in here.
As far as I know, he is.
He's turning 78, so yes, he is.
Yeah. Also born on the same date in 1950, English drummer and sculptor Dennis Elliott.
And American actor and dancer Patrick Swayze would have been 69 today.
That's right. Also born on the same date in 1954, Italian astrophysicist, astronaut, and politician Ubuntu Guidoni.
Guidoni. It's the kind of pasta. Never mind. Also turning 64 today, an American comedian, actor, producer, screenwriter, Dennis Leary.
And also, born on today, was American actor and producer Malcolm Jamal Warner. He's 51.
Theo from The Cosby Show is 51. Yeah. Don't you feel old now?
Yeah.
Don't you feel like your life...
She should. No, I don't, because I'm only a year older than he is.
Yeah, but what have you done with your life? Listener birthdays this week include August 19th is Brian Litecki, also Matt Ryder, same day. August 20th, Jedi Kez, a.k.a. Brian from Winnipeg. Zoidberg is on the 20th. Who knew Zoidberg had a birthday?
He was born in 1967.
Right. Well, and he lived till the year 3000 something.
Yeah.
So that's because he kept missing the spawning and never had to die. Kyle Slingle, also on the 22nd. Third one on the 22nd is Alchemy Dragon. And August 24th, daughter of our good friend and listener, Kira Fiore. So happy birthday, right. Kira.
Oh, hey, happy birthday.
She's got to be like 20 now. The way kids grow up in podcasts faster than normal.
Right. It's like for every year, it's like 7 years. Oh, that's dog years.
Where are you going with that?
acceleration of birthday age.
That's the way it was on this day in history for August 18th, 2021. If you want to be on the Technorama birthday calendar, go over to chuckchat.com/wiki. Didn't seem like we took that much time, but we did.
Yeah.
Let's
take it away, boys.
Oh, I probably should have taken down the pre-show title 20 minutes ago and put up the one that says, here's how you can get on the birthday calendar, chuckchat.com/birthday. Chat room should tell me, but chat room's on another browser tab at the moment.
Yeah, they're too busy enjoying us.
Yep. Okay. So now that you've seen that, I can remember to take that down. Let's do a random news sound. Okay, that didn't happen.
I'm waiting.
Oh, the sound app just bombed on me.
I'm listening.
Good news, anyone?
There we go. That'll work.
There we go.
Go ahead. Take the first story, Craig.
All right. So one of my favorite old computers, which I didn't never really get enough of, is the Amiga. And it's the latest game system to get a mini retro remake. So Commodore's Amiga 500, a home computer that became popular, a popular game system, is receiving a remake. The A500 Mini is being developed by Retro Games Limited, which previously released a mini version of the Commodore 64. The Amiga 500 was the most successful of the Amiga line of PCs, which started to appear in the mid-80s and drew a devoted following as a gaming system, particularly in Europe. While the A500 Mini is clearly based on the Amiga 500, Retro Games Limited says it will also emulate the more powerful AGA graphics hardware from the Amiga 1200, also a very popular one. So it has a list of games. I don't need to read all those, but there's Battle Chess. Right. Oh my gosh, that was so cool. Anyway, there are several games in there that's coming. There'll be 25 included in total, and you'll also be able to download or add more yourself with the WHD load. Not sure what that is. An installation package for the Amiga software. Now I know what that is. And other systems function include ability to switch between 50 and 60 hertz screen refresh rate, save states, and a built-in CRT filter, I guess to make it look like a CRT, and various scaling options.
Have you ever used an Amiga?
Yes.
What did you
I never
think?
Owned one, but I did. Yes, yeah, I love this.
I never owned one, but I used one.
They were great, and they were... Like the Commodore, you know, for some things, it was ahead of really everything. Like for
these were
sound.
Made by Commodore. What do you mean, that's like right. The Commodore? You mean like the C64?
I mean, I'm sorry, the C64. I want to say it's Commodore. I'm just thinking the C64. You're right. So the C64 was ahead, especially for sound. You know, they had that sound chip, and it was so good. This was even better, and it included some really cool graphic stuff. And that was groundbreaking at the time, too.
Hang on a sec. It's an optical illusion. It looked like there was a Texas Instruments sticker on that thing.
No.
What?
No. But it'll be released early next year, and it'll cost $139.
That's not bad.
No.
The only part about the Amiga that I used that I didn't like was that mouse. That had to be the worst ergonomic mouse in the history of mice, except for Douglas Engelbart's wooden square that he first came out with.
Actually, that one might have been better than this one.
Yeah.
Well, this, you know, that mouse reminds me, Logitech had some bricks that looked kind of like that early on. And what was that one? It was started with a Z, but it came with like a, or at least the one I remember, it had the name started with a Z or something. And it had like a metal plate for the mouse pad.
Oh, so the optical mice. Yes. With the
it would track you have using that metal plate.
Right.
There
was no mechanics. So there was no mouse balls. There was no gunk to clean out. Those were nice until the metal plate got scratched up. But even the Logitech one, we had those on the old Apollos, same kind of mouse.
Yeah. And they look similar to this.
It was lower profile though. It didn't hurt your hand. And there was at least a 3-button version of it. This thing, I used it for 10 minutes and my hand hurt. I said, this is terrible. It was just, it shouldn't hurt to use a mouse.
No, it should not. This is pretty cool. And again, it's the mini one, like the Commodore came out. It was small. But they, I think they since had a re-release of the Commodore 64 in full size that you can buy. And it's pretty close to the original.
With so, Wi-Fi. Anyway. Hmm? With Wi-Fi.
Yeah. I would love to have one, even the Amiga. But, you know, to be honest with you, I'd be happy with just an emulator on my own computer to go back and play some of these games. But, oh well.
Yeah, I'd like to give it a second chance and go, what was the Amiga doing at that time as compared to the others? Because it was a very advanced computer. But every time someone said, oh, you got to look at these awesome graphics, they'd always show that same red and white checkerboard ball spinning around. Like, yeah, fascinating. What else you got? So I'd like to see some of these games and see what they took advantage of.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of good games for it. But, yeah, the Battle Chess, that one, I think it's from EA.
Okay.
That was the one where the chess pieces would, you would go for here, you know, move your piece, and it would go over there and knock the piece down.
I remember seeing
a
demo of that, yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. And I had that, I want to say I had that on the Commodore 64. I keep wanting to say Commodore. The Commodore. There's a VIC-20 also, but I'm talking about the 64.
All right, let's go on to our next story then, because we have a story about asteroid Bennu. They say it has a 1 in 1,750 chance of smashing into Earth.
Ew.
That's pretty good odds. So data collected from NASA spacecraft visit to the potentially hazardous asteroid Bennu reveals future generations will want to keep a close eye on the big rock as it makes close passes by Earth in the 22nd century. So we're in the 21st century, so you know, sometime in the next 100 years or so. Researchers used information from the OSIRIS-REx mission. No, that's not a dinosaur. It spent over 2 years orbiting, studying, and even sampling Bennu to get a better idea of its future path through the inner solar system. They found the minuscule chance that the 1,700-foot wide or 518-meter boulder will impact our planet in the future. It's actually slightly higher than previously thought, but still nothing to lose sleep over. I'll be taking a permanent dirt sleep by that year. The author quotes, I'm not any more concerned about Bennu than I was before. That's a quote from David Farnocchia.
Farnocchia.
Of NASA's Center for Near-Earth Object Studies, or CENIOS. He told reporters on a call Wednesday, the impact probability remains small. That probability is, as we stated earlier, 1 in 1,750, or 0.06%, between now and the year 2300. And we can rule out any chance of impact between today and 2135. That's the year Bennu will come closer to Earth than the moon in September.
And you can watch that little graphic that they have in the tweet, and they're talking about the keyholes.
Yes.
It goes right, you know, shows how they kind of use that to line up the trajectory, I guess. Yeah.
He said there's no threat of a collision during those close passes, but before OSIRIS-REx, there had been some significant uncertainty about how some effects like our planet's gravity could alter the path of the asteroid, perhaps making a later impact more likely. Good stuff. Long article. Fairly long. We're not going to read the whole thing to you because that would be boring podcasting. But just wanted to let you know, you don't have to change your will today.
Not yet.
Just make sure you live far, far away from your kids so someone inherits something somewhere.
Right.
All right, that takes care of the news. Let's do a quick shout out to the chat room. We saw some familiar, friendly names in the chat room. We have John Miller Jr., Scott Tyler, Craig Glasner.
Yeah,
there. I haven't talked to him in a while. good friend of the show, Gary Lindros, is hanging around. I don't see anybody responding over on YouTube, but hey, we'll see. Maybe if I do a refresh. Nope, still nobody.
Hey, wait a minute, one more time.
Well, it said started streaming 83 seconds ago. Something's not updating.
Oh, yeah, that don't sound right.
Yeah, they never update that. So we're good. We're good. Hanging out here on a Sunday night at 9:30 Eastern time. We'd love to see you around. Love to interact with you. Get some clever banter going in the chat. And, you know, that's kind of how it goes. While we record the podcast, that's going to be released on Wednesdays. But if you watch this on Sunday night and there's nothing else on TV, well, hey, you saved yourself some time listening to a podcast later. Either one is fine with us. You could even do both. If you could listen to the podcast at double speed, however, hey, this in real time.
If you're home, yeah. Hey, if you're home, turn off the TV, put down the book, come turn on the internet.
Ignore the kids.
That's right. Just put on the headphones and, you know, forget everything.
You park the kids in front of the TV. No, we're just kidding. We're just kidding. So that brings us up to Remember When segment. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. You've got this one.
All right. So the Mayflower, 400 years later. How many people are related to the Mayflower pilgrims?
Mayflower, where are they today?
Yeah, where are they now? Just over four centuries ago, the ship, the Mayflower, sailed from Plymouth to the UK. Shores, I'm sorry, from Plymouth in the UK to the shores of America, carrying with it a group of travelers who would go down in history. For some, these 17th century pilgrim fathers are real life ancestors, but for how many? There are a few estimates out there, but all of them are quite high. According to the General Society of the Mayflower Descendants, there are 35 million Mayflower descendants in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. Those guys were busy.
and a lot of them didn't live past the age of five.
Yeah. And while I hope they had some, you know, never mind. I'll move along. Messed up here. Anyway, and while many Americans are proud to be recent arrivals or second generation immigrants, making the nation a unique blend of cultures for others, there are an incentive to claim ancestry to these early European arrivals. So Dr. Lauren Working, yes, that's her name, Dr. Lauren Working.
Is Dr. Lauren Working?
No, she's off today. an American historian at the University of Oxford believes there is an almost
aristocratic
prestige attached to tracing your family back to the Mayflower. It continues to give people a sense of authority, of shared connections with the past. There are so many jokes about America being so young and not really having much of a history. And so I thought that the Mayflower is something that people can kind of latch onto and give themselves a sense of grounding rather than everyone seeing themselves as migrants or refugees or travelers, as travelers. So can a 35 million number really be true, or might it be inflated by some wishful thinking? The figure seems high, especially when you look at the numbers. There were 102 passengers, around 30 crew, that set sail on the Mayflower on 1620, mm-hmm. September 1620. Some of them were fleeing religious persecution in England, and others were traveling to America to set up new commercial ventures. Many of the travelers were family groups or couples. In fact, three children were born on the voyage itself. Whew. That's got to be tough. One person was swept overboard. That's not good either. So they had a net two as they got to America. Net two of the people that came. From the moment they first stepped on the shore, the passengers faced terrible conditions, says historian Misha Ewan.
Wait, did you skip ahead?
Then I'm sorry. The journey was an exhausting one, lasting 10. The journey was exhausting, lasting almost 10 weeks at sea. When they reached America in November, they founded a colony called Plymouth. So they significant that was that moment that Plymouth Rock, a piece of the stone that the passengers supposedly first stepped onto, has been preserved and displayed. Now, from that moment they first stepped on the shore, the passengers faced terrible conditions, says historian Misha Ewan. The ground was icy and hard, making it difficult for them to plant any of their own food, which meant that they had to resort to searching through local settlements and actually pillaging food from Native Americans.
Great way to make a first impression.
Yeah. So you start thinking about it, the chances of getting up to 35 million descendants is getting on thin. It's having to starve and freezing. And so anyway,
fast forward, how did they, who were the Mayflower passengers? 102 passengers and about 30 crew, as you said earlier. Mm-hmm. 37 were English pilgrims who came via the Netherlands seeking freedom from religious persecution. We've heard that in school. Yeah. Only 53 of the Mayflower Voyagers survived the first winter in America. Yikes. Wow. Okay. So cut in half almost immediately. In the autumn of 1621, the colonists celebrated their first successful harvest by sharing a feast with some local Native Americans that they had established relations with. This was the first, yes, you guessed it, 4th of July. No, it was the first Thanksgiving feast.
Christmas.
But war later followed in the 1660s as thousands of Native Americans were killed or sold into slavery by indentured servitude by English colonists. Oh, we're making even a better first impression.
Mm-hmm.
The Mayflower Pilgrims weren't the first English settlers. Jamestown in Virginia was founded 13 years before. So let's see if we can find a little mathematics here as we scan through. Let's see. The phenomenon is known, but if a Mayflower person marries another Mayflower person and has two children, then the two descendants are simply replacing the two parents and there's no increase at all, he adds. Mm-hmm. And that had a dramatic effect. This phenomenon is known as pedigree collapse, and it is a big factor in the early years of Mayflower settlement. Of the 27 marriages that produced children in the founding Mayflower generation, 16 of them were between Mayflower passengers and descendants. But more ships did arrive, bringing new non-Mayflower people, meaning that the number of descendants expanded significantly. Nevertheless, pedigree collapse was definitely a factor, as Rob Eastaway's family know as well. My father-in-law discovered that their family is descended from Richard Warren. But not only that, they think that probably my wife and children also descended from John Howland. There's also even an example of potential pedigree collapse in his own family. So what might the real numbers look like? Well, these are always going to be ballpark figures, but using his 2 million descendant calculation for Richard Warren, Rob makes a rough estimate that the highest possible number of descendants for all 22 Mayflower families would be around 30 million. But once you factor in the clear evidence of pedigree collapse, Rob estimates the actual number of descendants would be around a tenth of that, or about 3 million. So, still a lot of people. That's pretty cool.
You know, I forget the actual statistics, but I remember reading a story about how many generations, kind of probably similar to this, where people were not related, but there's been so much, breeding between, population that I'm trying to think of it as I'm talking about it. How people are kind of related, but they're spread out. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
It's just from the way, like this, you're talking about from a small group of people and it starts spreading out. Well, all these 30 million people or 3 million people are technically related. It's just interesting statistics when you start talking about, ancestry like this.
Pretty soon someone's got three arms. That's a little too much inbreeding, people. You're going to need some new genes in the gene
pool. That's a little too close generation gap. You got to spread it out.
All right. We have some remastered Apollo 15 photos for you to share over on the show notes at chuckchat.com/technorama, episode 648. We're on. Thank goodness the browser tab tells you.
Yeah.
Remastered photos obtained from USA Today show new images of Apollo 15 mission at its 50th anniversary. These photos were enhanced by the author of Apollo Remastered, Andy Saunders. They show astronauts driving the lunar roving vehicle, the first car on the moon, and collecting lunar material. So is there now a used car lot up there?
Well, pretty much. I guess it's still there.
It's got one car lot. Come on up to Crazy Neil's used car lot.
Crazy Neil.
Everything must go. We have Crazy one vehicle, deal. One deal.
We're dealing. If you get up here.
We won't strong arm you into a deal you don't want.
It's like, I know we talked about this show before, but the Salvage One, where they built the rocket to go salvage some the junk from the moon.
Yeah,
I can see them taking a wrecker up there and pulling the
a tow truck,
moon buggy on
putting a flatbed.
I'm repoing this sucker.
Astronauts David R. Scott, James Irwin, and Alfred M. Warden all entered lunar orbit during the Apollo 15 mission on July 29th, 1971. I vaguely remember that. Let's see. Saunders, who had been remastering photos from Apollo missions for nearly 10 years and has gone through 35,000 images, that's almost as many as I have on Google Photos, told USA Today that there are incredible photographs from the missions. However, many haven't been seen because the quality wasn't there. Quote, but with digital enhancements, suddenly now we can see things that we couldn't see before. And they're amazing images. Never mind the aliens in the background, people.
Yeah. Look away.
The events have become more incredible as time goes, he added. To achieve this today would be incredible. But to do it 50 years ago is just like...
It's even more so. Man.
So check out the remastered images. Like I said, we can see... The Hadley Rill, we can see the lunar module 3.8 kilometers away. Oh, there's just arrows pointing on there. But wow.
This is
before and really after. Cool? It's like one's all washed out in white. Like, is there something in there?
Yeah.
And they actually enhanced it. And suddenly it looks like a beautiful moon picture. And you're like, whoa, there's the lunar lander is in frame. You didn't even see that before. So
you know, amazing, you know what's
stuff.
Cool?
Yeah.
Hey, by the way, this article, the lunar lander where he's sitting on it, that you're talking about that picture, right?
No, I was talking about the side by side, like the before and after, like the second image you see.
Oh yeah. It looks like he's in a snowstorm and next one,
right?
You can actually see everything. If you right click on these pictures and do open a new tab, they're actually full size versions. I don't know why they didn't give you an option to see them. And it's really cool to see these. That you can actually see inside the tire. You know, the tire was like a wire mesh so that the moon dust would come out of it. You can see inside the tire.
And the magic word for moon dust is regolith. Every time you hear the word regolith, take a drink.
Regolith. Okay. Yeah.
Never mind.
Actually, the control panel for that thing, you can read it says heading, speed.
Neat.
Something nav power. Okay. System reset. There's a shadow over the word. Gyro ground. Ground, not grounding. It's pretty cool. You know, one day we're gonna be able to go back to the moon. Somebody's gonna be able to walk up there and take pictures of this and see what it looks like.
With real high definition cameras.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder what it looks like nowadays. I'm sure a lot of the stuff's kind of been, you know, washed out or tore up because of the radiation or whatever.
I think it's probably in near pristine condition. I mean, there's no wind. The footprints are still up there.
No, I think radiation's probably the worst thing. And maybe some dust kick up.
Dust kick up from how? There's no wind. Like I said, the footprints are still there.
You know, if something impacts the moon. You still have impacts on the moon?
Doesn't happen all that often as you would think.
Well, I'm looking at a bunch of holes when it did.
Over the last several billion years, sure.
Yeah.
It's not like every other weekend. It's like, hey, look.
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, hey, how can you say that?
Because there's got to be some, but they're not. It's not like it's getting sandblasted twice a week.
You know what?
What?
You can go up there and there's going to be a big rock sitting in the middle of that rover.
Well, that's where they parked it, in front of the rock.
No, I meant on top of it.
Oh, not on top of it. No, if there is, it's going to be little micro fragments because you think
we see meteor showers all the time.
I'm not saying that's where I was going. I'm not saying there's nothing happening, but there's no wind blowing up dust storms like there is on Mars because there's no atmosphere. No. But right. Devil. When we go through a meteor shower, most of the things we see in the light in as streaks of light mm-hmm. are small as a grain of sand. So,
oh yeah,
like oh, and how many do you see in those? Like, what is it? 10 an hour. That's a good meteor shower, and it's across the whole sky. So, okay, so maybe 10 an hour. Somewhere on the moon. The moon's a lot smaller, so let's call it 6 an hour. It's not a lot of stuff running into the moon and not big stuff.
Well, I guess, over time, I guess a lot of that stuff's
A piece of sand landed on the seat in the moon rover. How about that?
I saw more than 10 an hour when I was up in the mountains. I saw
it. And you were looking across the whole sky. How many landed in your yard?
None. But I will say that I didn't expect any to, but it was funny. Did I talk about this on here? I was walking the dog and it was like 5 a.m. and I looked up and I went, oh, there's a satellite. Oh, there's a meteor. There's another one. There's another one. I was like, oh, I went and got my coffee and sat outside and watched them. I bet I saw 30 or 40 of them.
This is a good time of year for it.
Yeah, actually, just last week was the Perseids coming back through, wasn't it?
I think that was the Perseids are in August. Perseids,
excuse me.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep, yep. So, and there's usually something floating around that will catch your eye. It's good to see them as a streak, because if you just see it as a point and it gets brighter, it's coming right at you.
Go somewhere. Underground.
Stepped 3 feet to the left, you'll be fine.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay, let's switch topics over to woolly mammoths.
Yes. So scientists map out 17,000-year-old woolly mammoth's path using its tusks.
Okay, I'm guessing there's probably some isotopes involved. I've been listening to Tim Smith's podcast.
Oh, right. So we might think of woolly mammoths as giant, lumbering beasts from a disappearing area.
Didn't you watch the Ice Age movie?
Yes, I did.
Ray Romano was great.
Thank you for your commentary, Mr. Tomasi.
It's the sloths that you never really see on cave paintings.
That's right. Anyway, they're lumbering beasts from a disappeared era. But the new study suggests that their massive size didn't stop them from tallying major miles. They were getting the steps in the frigid north thousands of years ago. It's not clear cut if it was seasonal migrator.
You've managed to say 8 words and got 3 of them right.
It is not clear cut if it is a seasonal migrator, but it covered some serious ground, explains the University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher Matthew Wooler, which is an appropriate name for this.
Matthew Wooler Mammoth.
I think they're making this up in a statement. It visited many parts of, I started to say parks.
In Alaska. Yeah.
Yeah. Alaska. Some of the national parks visited many parts of Alaska at some point during its lifetime, which is pretty amazing when you think about how big that area is.
You know how big Alaska is? It's like the size of Alaska.
Yeah. Times two. I don't know. I just threw that in.
Back then, maybe when the sea levels were lower.
That's right. So Wooler led a team using chemical isotope.
Ding, ding, ding.
Data to a map of life journey of a single mammoth that lived 17,000 years ago. A paper on the findings is the cover story of this week's issue of the journal Science. I read that all the time. So the group of international researchers analyzed isotopic signatures in the male mammoth's tusks from the elements strontium.
Haven't been listening to Tim Smith's podcast,
no,
have you?
No, I have not. I've been trying to keep up with everybody's podcast. Strontium and oxygen. Then cross-referenced that data with maps of isotope variations across Alaska created from analyzing the teeth of the small rodents from around the state.
There you go.
Hmm.
So Tim Smith is doing his podcast this year he normally does a podcast called Endurance Sports Medicine and something around
as,
that.
as part of the Dog Days of Podcasting.
As part of the Dog Days of Podcasting, his topic this year is about isotopes and some really fascinating stuff. He starts out at a very basic level, like here's an atom, this is helium, we've got deuterium, and builds up from that. And he had a really interesting one about King George, was it? And they could tell where he lived. He talked about Utsi the Iceman. So by analyzing what's in these people's bodies, you can figure out where they lived. I mean, to within a few miles of, like, hey, this valley has different water or different ground content.
The elements in the dirt or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And you can find how, by looking at the various elements and their isotopes, which are the variations of it. So there's carbon-12, carbon-14, carbon-13, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, just depending on how many neutrons are in it. You can figure out a whole lot of stuff just by looking at this. So they did the same thing with the mammoth. So we should send this article over to him. And you'll hear it on the Dog Days of Podcasting.
Actually, you know what? I will. I'm going to do it right now.
Well, we're in the middle of recording something. Do it after we're done.
Oh, come on.
All right, you can do that while I'm thanking the patrons. How's that for a trade-off?
Okay, that'll work.
All righty. Thank you to our patrons who bring us this show. You are responsible for paying our bills on time. Well, I pay them on time, but you're funding the bank account that pays for those bills. For as little as a dollar a show, and I'll actually try and be on time with this, put the banner up there, go over to patreon.com/technoramapodcast. People like the likes of Alexis Duran, Amber Elstad, Amy Bowen, Avner Braverman, Ben Vaughn, Brian Brown, Chris MC, Dan D. Mancoyer, Dean Jensen, Denise Inglis, Gary Lindros. Hey, he was in the chat a little while ago. Thank you very much to all these people. They make this show happen. And
we're going to check their isotopes and see where they've been.
Yes, because this is our periodic table of patrons. Thank you, Harold McKinstry, as we move on to John Clifford 12, John Noble 13, Yorga Schrawen. If you check your strontium on Yorga, you'll find he's pretty cool. Christina and Kyle Nishioka, Leon, rhymes with neon.
Yeah.
Mark Kilfoyle, Mike Wills, Chris Martinez, Saturday Morning Media. That's one of those heavy elements. Stephen Weshey, Steve Therian, Steve Cody, and I'm pretty sure Steve London is manufactured in a laboratory only by scientists, doesn't occur in nature. Thank you, everybody. Again, patreon.com/technoramapodcast. Not only do these people get puns made about their names, apparently, but they also get a special episode of Technorama that we release to them ahead of the regular show. And it is Craig and I going deep into scientific and psychological, and sometimes it's just what's happened to our family in the last week. So thank you very much. We appreciate it. And let's move on. Oop, that was the wrong fader. I almost muted Craig, which, you know, would have been for a boring show, me just talking to myself. And we roll into... Well, I know what that music means. It means it's time for the 6 o'clock news.
Yes. And over to you, Chuck.
I'm Jack Ethernay.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't think it's any big secret, but, you know, on Disney Plus, they started releasing the next series of Marvel shows, which is What If. Now, What If is a comic, and I'm probably not telling anybody anything that they don't already know, but the What If comic, I remember some of them were humorous, some of them were more like just twists on characters. It's like Marvel Universe has a multiverse, and within the multiverse, there are endless possibilities. So part of the comic, the What If comic, they would always ask, well, what if Peter Parker was a girl or Spider-Man was a girl? And
then it'd be Spider-Woman.
Yeah, and like, here you go, what if Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? There's a bunch of different
then
ones.
It'd be the Fantastic Five. These aren't very hard questions to answer.
No, but it does bring a good twist to a lot of these characters and some interesting stories. and they're kind of one-offs. They don't necessarily, you know, it's not an ongoing series where one leads to another, but there's always a one-off story about what would happen if, or what if. So they started doing the Disney special or series called What If. And I thought it was a lot of fun. It was instead of Captain America, it was Captain Carter. What if Agent Carter had gotten the serum and became a superhuman like Captain America did? And you see a lot of the same story beats that you see in the Captain America movies. Actually, it's the first two Captain America movies.
She'd look like the Amazonian women from Futurama.
Oh, yeah. So when...
No, Captain Carter makes snoo-snoo.
Well, it was kind of amazing. She lays in the thing and it closes up like the one in the movie. Mm-hmm. And when it opens, Howard Stark goes over there and you can see she's physically taller than he is. And he's trying to help her out. Yeah, she is kind of big and a little bit built. You know, she's got the suit on, the British flag and the shield. It was a lot of fun to watch. The animation was great. I thought the story was good. It was a little fast. You know, they were skipping through a lot of the stuff because there was a lot of room to cover. But it was fun. It was really good. I'm looking forward to the next one. Actually, it'll be out by the time you're listening to this. So go check that out. What If on Disney Plus.
Sounds fun. Thank you very much. And I believe we got a couple things in the Geek Library. Then we're going to head on out of here. Our first one is about an auto-aiming bow. Okay. Well, that kind of takes the fun out of archery.
Well, so. I don't know. His build process was interesting, so I would say it put the fun back in it. So I forget what this guy's name is. I just recently found his YouTube channel, but the YouTube channel is called Stuff Made Here.
Holy catfish. He released this video 2 days ago and he's already got 3.3 million views on it.
Yeah. So what he did was he took an archery bow and you just basically put your hand in it and hold. It's like a 3D printed sleeve, but I'm not sure what you call it, a handle on it. And the bow is allowed to move separately from your hand, but it's attached, you know, it's a, like with the gears and motors and stuff. So The idea is it's supposed to automatically aim the bow in the right spot and hit the right targets. So it was interesting to see him build it, troubleshoot it, fix the code. And his wife actually was an archer. So she was like, he was trying to figure out how accurate she was versus his machine. And of course, the first time out, he nailed it, or she nailed it, excuse me. And he was like, okay, back to the drawing board. So he had bugs. Clearly back to formula on the code one time, which was interesting. And he ended up finding the physical reason why it wasn't working right. And I'll let you watch the video. But my first thought when I saw the title went, I thought, that would be really cool. You know, you're outside trying to, but you know, I can't use it outside and use it because he's got cameras that help track. And you'll see in the video how he does that. So anyway, go check it out. It's 17 minutes long. A lot of fun to watch. I thought he did a great job with the video. And I skipped ahead and watched some other ones. He made a machine to give himself a haircut, which sounds scary. He made a haircut robot. He put his head up in this hole and the robot's got an arm and it's coming out it's using like a Flowbee kind of thing, you know, where it pulls your hair. And it kind of cuts, but it had scissors. And I was like, there's no way I'm putting my head towards a robot with scissors.
It's like one of those suicide booths.
Yeah. Anyway, he does a good job with his videos and he's a smart guy. So check it out.
I spotted an Arduino or a variation of it on one of his devices. So yeah, a lot of cool stuff about the electronics. Excellent. We also have another YouTube video, Pizza Delivered to Space.
Yes, this is
not there in 30 minutes or less.
Yeah, well, I hope they tipped him well.
The description reads, the International Space Station got an eagerly anticipated delivery this week, a cargo ship containing fresh apples, tomatoes, and kiwis. And, best of all, pizza for seven. The space pizza isn't the first culinary treat on the ISS to make the news. In June, the commander of the space station actually ordered it. I'm just kidding. He made a sort of crepe by smearing chocolate and strawberries on a tortilla. Sort of a crepe. That's a bit of an imagination to call that.
I think
crepe.
It's like the most basic version of a crepe.
It's like on Bad Santa. He's like frying bologna in a pan. He goes, there, it's a tostada.
Yeah.
Though Commander Thomas Pesquet is, in fact, French, his skills in the kitchen reportedly are not out of this world.
Well, this is pretty cool. And they delivered the ingredients. They didn't actually deliver a piping hot pizza.
Apologies. It's probably Thomas Pesquet, if I can interpret my French. I probably butchered his name three times there.
All right.
You know, in only saying it twice, I managed to massacre it three times.
Yeah. Okay, well, I thought it was funny, you know, about delivering a pizza in space. So.
It can be done, people. There is now I'm curious to know what the actual cost of constructing and delivering that pizza, because isn't the going payload to launch something like $10,000 a pound?
Yeah, so probably. Pizza. Well, they delivered the ingredients, not the pizza itself. So,
oh, you still had to put it together.
Yeah, it's you had to assemble it.
Well, you know, that makes sense because you can do that. You got the crust and then you smear it with the tomato sauce and then everything else kind of sticks to that. Because otherwise, if you didn't want any sauce, the cheese would just kind of float off of the crust and it wouldn't really bake. You need gravity to hold the thing together normally, but you use the sauce as kind of like a glue. You have to have foods that stick together.
That's right. That's right.
Do they have a pizza oven up there? How did they cook it? Did they just wave it out the window and the cosmic radiation?
They sent one of those up too.
And for dessert,
you know what? My luck, I would be able to go to the International Space Station and somebody would end up burning popcorn in the microwave.
And leave the coffee pot on till the coffee was all burnt. Like, yep, this is just like a day at the office.
That's right.
Nothing like it. Or they had like stinky fish for dinner. Like, oh, man, like
we had somebody do that in our office one time, not at where we work, but an old company. And this guy, he was from Africa and he would always have some interesting dishes, and he has a fish one and he put it in a microwave and he got the attention of everybody in the office. They were never again. Do not put fish in the microwave.
April Fools, we got you. All right, we are going to skedaddle on out of here. We've got another show to record.
Question of the week.
Question of the week. We'll get that in during the song. Question of the week this week is, what's a fact that's real but sounds completely fake?
The fact that we've been podcasting for 16 years.
Getting away with it so far.
It's real. And it's a fact.
And the fact is, we're not stopping anytime soon.
No.
So, thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach out to us on the voicemail line. 707-530-2428. 707-530-CHAT. Send us an email, technorama@chuckchat.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Until then, Craig, give him a binary high five.
All right. 101, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Stay safe.
Child support. That's what I was trying to think of earlier for the $35 million. Yeah.